We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host Ariel Garten, one of the founders of brain-sensing headband Muse. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation, mindfulness, and brain-focused practices have the power to change our lives. Whether you're just learning to meditate or want to deepen your practice, Meditation Studio, with hundreds of guided meditations, and Muse, which provides great biofeedback on your practice, are two awesome tools you'll want to have in your back pocket. Some of you may have heard of today's guest, Dan Harris. Dan is the co-anchor of Nightline and the weekend edition of Good Morning America on ABC News. In 2014, he published a book called 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and found self-help that actually works. A pivotal life moment for Dan was when he had a panic attack on live television in front of, about 5 million viewers. This, needless to say, was a giant wake-up call. He writes about this journey in 10% Happier. His recent book, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, takes his first book one step further. It goes deeper into what it actually takes to teach meditation to fidgety skeptics like Dan. He's fun, irreverent, brutally honest, and shares everything from how he manages conflict with his co-writer and meditation teacher to how he handles some of the everyday annoyances, triggers, and crankiness that we all have with those we love the most. He definitely tells it like it is. He's the first to tell you that his life has changed about 10% for the better since he started his meditation practice. As we hear a lot in this podcast, it's a practice. The more we do it, the more it helps. Now, here's Dan. Dan, it's great to have you on Untangle today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. First question, why did you decide to write this second book, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics?
Primarily because I realized there was a flaw in my first book. I kind of naively assumed that anybody who read my first book, which was called 10% Happier, which is basically my personal story of how I became a meditator, I had this kind of cavalier attitude that, I made a good case in my book, told my personal story, and people who read the book will start meditating. And it was abundantly clear to me, basically, on the day the book came out, that that's not how it works, that forming habits, healthy habits, is really hard. People. And I also, after the book came out, I started an app. We teach people how to meditate through an app called 10% Happier. And that gave me really a front row seat to the rich pageant of human neuroses that stop people from embracing this healthy habit, even when they want to. Basically, what I learned is that evolution did not bequeath us a brain or a mind that is good at long-term health planning. Evolution didn't care about your long-term health. It cared about getting your DNA into the next generation. So it left us with these brains that are really good at finding threats, saber-toothed tigers or whatever, and also finding sources of food and sexual partners, and not great at making sure we do stuff that will ensure our long-term health. And so that's why I wanted to write this book, to really get under the hood and figure out what's stopping people and how to give people a bunch of hacks to be able to start doing this thing. Also, the book teaches you how to meditate.
Yeah, well, you go a lot deeper into actual meditation and the practice in the book. It's more of, I'd say, a how-to. But let's step back for a half a second. What was the hardest thing for you when you first started to learn to meditate? And did that kind of inform some of what you talk about in this new book?
I'd say two things for me. One is that I thought meditation was bullshit. So like I wasn't particularly interested in doing it at all. I got interested in stumbled upon it in about 2009, I think. So this is the first time in my life I was ever ahead of a trend. It took a while after that to get cool. And to the extent that I'd ever considered meditation before 2009, I thought it was just ridiculous. And what changed my mind was just seeing all the science that suggests it has lots of tantalizing health benefits. So that was the first problem I had, just getting over the hump of thinking it was useless. And then the other was that I'm fidgety. Not only am I skeptical, I'm a fidgety skeptic, as in the title of the book. And I'm not particularly good at sitting still. My work in a business that really rewards kind of racing mind, always planning, worrying, that kind of thing. And I just didn't think I could stop thinking. But as I learned very, very early on, and luckily I took this lesson on board, which a lot of people don't, which is that you don't have to stop thinking. It is impossible to stop thinking unless you're enlightened or you have died. The brain secretes thoughts the way the stomach secretes enzymes. It's just like, this is what the brain does and the mind. And the point is not to stop thinking. The point is to notice when you become distracted and start again and again and again. And that noticing when you become distracted, which is the point at which most people think they failed meditating, is actually a victory. And it's a victory with real consequences, because when you see how crazy you are, how easily distracted you are, how negative and repetitive and self-referential your thought processes are, then it doesn't own you as much. And those are two of the things we talk about in the book, and those are two of the things that I dealt with personally. But overall, I would say that my adoption of the meditation habit was actually reasonably seamless. And that is not because I'm particularly disciplined. In fact, I, as I mentioned in the book, in the not too distant past, ate so many Oreos one night that I woke up in the middle of the night and puked. I'm not known for my self-control.
Good to know.
I also quite famously had a cocaine habit. So like, I'm definitely not like Mr. Discipline, but what I have struggled with depression and anxiety much of my life. And first of all, the evidence that suggested that meditation was good for those conditions is pretty strong. And once I started to do it, I realized that it lowered the volume on my obnoxious inner narrator in such a way that I will go to great lengths to avoid another big bout of depression. And so that it made it kind of a no-brainer, so to speak, to keep doing this.
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the first teachings in the book has to do with exactly what you're talking about, these random thoughts that come and go, and how in meditation, we learn to choose not to pay attention to them or not to cling to them. What I always struggle with, and I'm just curious if this happens with you too, is we learn these tools to not ruminate as much within our meditation. How do we take that like off the cushion into the world? Like when something's nagging you at work or in your relationship, or so you just nag, ruminate, and you're walking around with this thing in your head. What do you do then? How do you take the tools that you've learned inside of your meditation into your real world?
Well, the first thing that meditation helps you do is just to see that it's happening. Not always, but often when we are just stuck on something, we don't even know it's happening, but it's making us cranky and irritable and distracted. And we sometimes may not even be aware that the process is happening. But that's not always the case. Sometimes we are aware and just frustrated that we can't stop thinking about it. There's a great expression that I talk about from my meditation teacher, a guy named Joseph Goldstein. He likes to say, when you notice that you're worrying about something like what's going to happen if you miss your flight, you know, it makes some sense to worry about that. But on the 18th time that you're running through all the horrible consequences of missing the flight, maybe ask yourself a very simple question, which is this useful? For me, as somebody who's always like venerated anxiety, you know, I've always thought anxiety is why I'm successful. And to a certain extent, that's true. You know, a certain amount of hypervigilance makes sense. But at some point, it becomes utterly unconstructive. And this little mantra, this little phrase you can repeat to yourself of like, oh, is this useful? Probably not. Maybe I can go think about something else. That is a great little tool. Now, of course, the worry or the rumination may come roaring back 30 seconds later or a nanosecond later. What meditation also teaches you how to do, and I probably should have led with this, is that it just over time, you gradually learn to smile at the chaos and unreliability and uncontrollability of your inner landscape and let it go and return to what it is you want to focus on. And that is a skill. It is often very difficult at the beginning, but you get better and better and you get an increased facility with it over time.
So what do you think it takes to be able to smile at that chaos? Is it to have a really powerful witness as your friend so that you can almost laugh at it? Or is it just practice, 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 and really disciplined training?
Yeah, it's practice. It's a little bit of fake it until you make it. And it's also lowering the bar. It's not like you're going to be perfect at this. It's not like every time I get angry, I smile at the anger and everything's roses. Some 10% of the time, it works. But that's better than 0% of the time. And I think that 10% can compound annually so that over time you are truly exponentially better at managing or surfing your inner cacophony than you used to be. But I'll give you a tool because for me, actually, even as I was working on this book is a road trip across the country, right, where one of my favorite meditation teachers, Jeff Warren, who's the co-author on the book, he and I set off across the country to meet people who want to meditate but aren't and help them get over the hump. And spending a lot of time in this stupid orange bus that we rented to drive across the country, sitting in this tin can with Jeff going across the country was actually kind of a privilege because I had a meditation teacher up close with me who could make some interesting diagnoses. And he noticed that I was not doing a very good job at having a sense of humor about my own distractions and urges and impulses and strong emotions, especially in meditation. I had to kind of grit your teeth, like a hostile attitude toward my own mind. And he came up with this little mantra, this little tool, this little phrase that you can say to yourself whenever you notice that you're being distracted in meditation, just say, "Welcome to the party." And I found that actually doing that, just saying that, which involves a lot of faking it until you make it, because actually you try to meditate and you start thinking about lunch, your first instinct is not to welcome that to the party. Your first instinct is to say, "Oh my God, I'm a horrible meditator. This is so annoying." You can welcome that to the party too. You can welcome the lunch thoughts and then you can welcome your judgment about the lunch thoughts. Welcome it all, because that is the point. The point of meditation is to be okay with all of the stuff that's zipping through your head so that it doesn't yank you around, so that it doesn't control you. So you're increasing your own visibility into your own consciousness so that you can surf it rather than be drowned in it. So when anger comes up, you're not spending an hour raging and doing a bunch of things you later regret, that actually you can maybe see it come up and let it pass. And it's a much more supple relationship with your own mind and with the world and with other people. The other thing that Jeff recommended that I didn't want to do because it sounded a little corny was, you know, he pointed out that if you take a close look at your mind, and this is actually backed up in many psychological theories about the way the mind works, that there are like 5, 6, 7, 8 primary characters who take control of your mind at any given moment. Like maybe it's anger, maybe it's jealousy, maybe it's a planner, like a logistician who's planning out the day. Maybe it's an ambitious voice who's thinking about my career. Jeff's point was name these people, give them names, give these characters names and greet them with a welcome to the party when they arise. Again, I thought this was kind of corny.
Right.
But I ended up doing it, and it made a big difference. And I sort of have developed a much more affectionate attitude toward this sort of inner cast of characters. And again, the value of that is that you're not taking it so seriously. Anger doesn't own you as much as it used to.
Well, this must have been somewhat intuitive to you in that you're so funny and you have such a great sense of humor externally. So this idea of being so serious in your meditation, it must have been fun to sort of see that shift with some of these quirky little tools. And I remember talking to Sharon Salzberg, and I think she named her inner anger or something. She named it Lucy. And it was just sort of a happy name for a not so happy emotion. What did you do? Like when you're in the bus. Okay. So
this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries, so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
I'm teaching you all these things. You're in this bus for how long was the tour?
11 or 12 days.
11 or 12 days. And you get hungry, you get cranky, you maybe get tired of each other. How does an author of meditation tools and ideas and narratives and a Buddhist teacher, how do the two of you handle conflict?
Yeah, well, so it's very interesting because we did have conflict. And just because you're either a meditation teacher or as I am, a meditation proponent, doesn't mean you never get into a bad mood.
Right.
That's actually my biggest, I interview a lot of spiritual teachers. My biggest way to test whether they're full of shit or not is to say, do you ever get into a bad mood?
Oh my gosh. Does anybody ever say no?
Yes.
Really?
Oh yeah. Eckhart Tolle says no.
Okay.
Now, I'm not actually convinced that Eckhart Tolle is full of shit, to be clear. But to me, it is something of an interesting sign. Deepak Chopra says the same thing. He doesn't get stressed. So yeah, I'm not sure I believe it, but that's, especially since I've seen Deepak pretty stressed. I've never seen Eckhart stressed, but I'm not a mind reader, so maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, I definitely get stressed and cranky and everything like that. I am far from enlightened or perfected. And same thing with Jeff. Jeff has serious ADD, which is actually part of one of the plots of the book is him becoming more comfortable talking about his own psychological issues because he was worried that he was like a meditation teacher with imposter syndrome. He was worried that people knew that he had ADD. They wouldn't take him seriously as a teacher, which I actually think the opposite is true. It's not his fault. He has ADD. He's done an incredible amount of work on it through meditation and other practices. And I think it makes him a better teacher, but that's just one of the sort of storylines that develops. But one of the problems with ADD, I learned through dealing with Jeff, that there are lots of flavors of ADD. His manifests not as an inability to pay attention, but as kind of a monomania. So he gets super focused for a while.
Yeah.
He gets super focused for a while and then he zips off into something else. And in the writing process, so this didn't happen on the bus. This happened when we got home and we had to write, but I'll tell you about something that happened on the bus in a minute. When we got home and had to write this book on very short notice, I was very stressed because I was doing most of the writing. So I was writing the sort of narrative, every chapter with a different stop along the tour, a different day. And I was writing all of that. And then Jeff's job was going to be to come along and plug in the meditation instructions. And he was sending me these lengthy memos about all these grandiose ideas he had for teaching meditation as it's never been taught before and blah, 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 with all these like arcane references to Buddhist sutras and all this stuff. And I was at my wit's end because I had this, I mean, I have a very active day job at ABC News. I have a wife and a child, and I'm trying to write this book on incredibly short notice, by which I mean, I had to write a chapter a week. And he's sending me these like turgid, abstruse exegeses on meditative theory. And I was so angry at him for doing this to me. You know, I just write some meditation instructions and put them in. Don't bother me with this stuff because this was my inner crankiness. He really touched a button with me and I was not well rested and calm enough to deal with it well. And so I was cranky and kind of an asshole about it. So we had like a month, 6 weeks of real tension. And it finally broke when we just got on the phone and talked it out. And it became clear to him that I was suffering because of the workload and that he was making it worse. And it became clear to me that I was just kind of writing him off. I was being a little short-tempered. And it really worked itself out. And I think in many ways made us closer. And there was very little, in fact, I would say zero real defensiveness. Because I think one of the things that meditation helps you do is to see through the stories you're telling yourself and also to be more able to listen to the stories people are telling themselves. And as Joseph Goldstein, my meditation teacher, although I would count Jeff as a teacher as well, but Joseph has a great expression, which is don't side with yourself. And that's a great way to approach interpersonal conflict, of being able to see things from the other person's point of view. But you asked about the bus. On the bus itself, we had a real situation because we had overscheduled ourselves and we were working our crew. We were recording everything. And so our camera crew was getting worked to the bone. And Eddie, our creative director, who was in charge of all of the video, was like not getting any sleep and was getting super cranky. And I don't think I fully understood how bad it was. And Eddie was like kind of snapping once in a while, and we had to have an intervention. And we literally just pull over at a bus stop in Louisiana and get out and have a talk. And then we got back on the bus and had a talk again. And, you know, it was interesting to, you know, it was the CEO of the 10% Happier Company, who's also a meditator, my Ben Rubin, who's the CEO of the aforementioned Eddie, Jeff, and me. And everybody else was hiding in the back because they thought there was a homicide that was going to get committed. But actually, like, once Eddie explained how we'd been kind of screwing him over with the schedule, and we just changed the schedule. And Eddie teared up a little bit. There were lots of hugs, and we literally canceled everything the next day, gave everybody the day off, and then trimmed out a bunch of other shoots that we had planned and just made everything much more sane going forward. Yeah. And it didn't turn into a big fight. As soon as we sat down and talked it out, it was like, oh yeah, here's a solution. Let's just do that.
Yeah, it's funny because I think once you've learned how to meditate, the time that you stew in your anger or your conflict, it gets shorter and shorter and shorter, hopefully. Interviewed Jonathan Faust, and he's the Buddhist teacher and spouse of Tara Brach, one of the top Buddhist teachers in the country, I think. And I asked him, how do two really skilled Buddhist teachers deal with conflict in their relationship? And he said, not very gracefully. And he went on to say, he said, when they first started having all of this conflict, it was horrible because he's a Quaker and really quiet and we hold everything to himself and be really passive aggressive and she's loud and she says what's on her mind. And they did exactly what you were just saying, which is they had to stop and do a role reversal. And the minute they did a role reversal, which in your words was what's the other person's point of view, they all of a sudden were like, oh, I get it. I would feel exactly the same way. And I thought that was so interesting. And I do think that that's a lot of what you learn. But it is, to me, really interesting because we stew in that conflict probably longer than we need to. And how does it translate in your relationship with your wife? Is she a skilled meditator like you are, or?
I'm not a skilled meditator.
Oh, okay.
I'm a dedicated meditator.
Dedicated.
Not skilled.
Okay.
My wife is an episodic meditator. So another plot line that plays out in the book. But so actually, until recently, she didn't do any meditation other than once in a while she would meditate with me on vacation or something like that. She wasn't hostile to the idea, but particularly she historically hasn't been very good at taking care of herself. She's a physician and is very good at taking care of other people, but didn't really take care of herself. And also it was a little annoying to be living with a meditation evangelist. And except at the beginning of when I started meditating, I did lecture her a little bit, totally backfired. And then I never said anything about it again, but the residue was there. And so she kind of resisted meditation for a bunch of reasons. Over the course of the book, though, Jeff got her to meditate.
Oh, wow. First book or the second book?
The second book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so in this book, you'll see how she ends up becoming a meditator. And so now she's a little reluctant to say that she's a daily meditator because she kind of often does it when she's lying in bed putting our son to sleep. She somehow thinks it's not legit meditation, but that's not true. It's totally actually gets a lot of meditation done. How do our conflicts go? We definitely have fights. I know they are drastically, dramatically, incalculably less venomous than they were, you know, in our early days. You can't even compare. But for sure, I get cranky and tired and will say something I later regret. But I think generally speaking, we work through stuff quite speedily.
Your meditation practice has helped. Do you think you've made some drastic changes in that area?
Yeah.
Maybe not so reactive. Do you take a little teeny pause maybe?
For sure. A lot of it is what mindfulness allows you to do is to see when you're annoyed or anxious or angry and you don't have to act on it. So if she's doing something that's annoying me, the old me would have just snapped. Often I'll just watch how it's playing out in my mind or my body. Usually when you're annoyed, it actually feels physically bad if you're paying attention. I'll just watch that happen. And instead of saying something when I'm in the grips of that annoyance, which will almost always lead to a fight because I'll say something not so skillful, I'll let it pass and make a decision. Is this worthy of bringing up or not? Most of the time it's not.
Right. Yeah.
I had noticed that she'd been kind of correcting me a lot. And sometimes in front of our child, who's three, I didn't like that. And I noticed that I was getting upset when it was happening, but I didn't want to say something while I was upset. And it happened again on like a weekend morning, and I kind of let it pass. And then when I calmed down, I said, I've just been noticing you've been correcting me a lot lately, and I find it kind of demeaning. And I gave her a few examples, and she was like, oh yeah, that's annoying. Oh, sorry, I won't do that anymore.
Well, that's good. That worked out nicely.
Yeah.
So there was word that I think you said in the book that was one of Jeff's favorite words, equanimity. And I'm just studying this now and having a little bit of a hard time with it because I get easily annoyed. And I want to understand, what does it mean to really embrace equanimity? And is that part of what you're doing when you get annoyed and you can pause and be aware and wait for that time when you actually respond to it and kind of turn off the noise inside your head?
Yeah. Again, you're not turning off the noise.
So turning down the noise, of course.
Or just seeing that it's there and in the seeing, in the being aware of what's happening, it will pass on its own because everything does. The reason why anger left to its own devices, something happens that makes you angry. You watch the news and you see somebody on there who makes you angry. The natural course of that anger, in my experience, is pretty quick, maybe a minute or two, maybe less. But if you're feeding it through neurotic obsession, it will just keep re-upping it. Equanimity doesn't mean that you're in a permanent bubble of bliss and that you're never experiencing any negative emotions. It's just that you aren't fighting with or feeding the negative emotion. You're allowing it to come up. You're seeing it clearly with some kind of curiosity, interest, good friendliness, and maybe like giving it a name. And then making a wise decision about how to respond wisely to the situation instead of just reacting blindly in the throes of the annoyance. And I really do, there's an expression that in some ways meditation hurts more, suffer less. In other words, so like the actual moment of annoyance, say my wife is doing something, I don't know, she's listening to the TV too loudly when I wake up in the morning. The annoyance, when I'm mindful of it, it really feels badly. It hurts, physically hurts. I mean, I think we don't realize that when we turn around and snap at somebody, we're trying to relieve this physical discomfort, at least in my experience. So when you're mindful, in many ways, it hurts more because you're actually aware of it. But you suffer less because you're less owned by it. You see it clearly. There's actually some delight in seeing it clearly, perversely. Yeah. And in that way, your life can become smoother. That's the equanimity Jeff's talking about, the ability to see clearly, and even with maybe a little friendliness, what's happening, what you're experiencing, what emotions you're experiencing without getting carried away by.
Yeah, I love that. So in the Buddhist teachings, that's part of four what are called immeasurables. And so in the book, you also say you're an avowed anti-sentimentalist. It's a mouthful. And do you integrate the other immeasurables, so to speak, loving kindness, compassion, joy, into your practice every day? Or is that something that you just do not integrate?
Oh, no, I totally do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, the four immeasurables in Buddhist speak, the Brahma Viharas, the heavenly abodes, it's kind of a grandiose term. Essentially, they're compassion, the desire to relieve the suffering of others, loving kindness, which is a really syrupy term for just basically friendliness, a desire to be friendly to everyone, including yourself. What's the third?
Mudita?
It's sympathetic joy.
Sympathetic joy, right.
Mudita, which is basically the opposite of schadenfreude, the celebration of other people's good fortune. And the fourth is equanimity, which is kind of the grease that allows all of these wheels to spin. So there are these meditation practices that come out of the Buddhist tradition, but they can be practiced in a very secular way that basically involve you envisioning people or animals and systematically sending them vibes. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be free of suffering, blah, blah, blah. And I found that to be completely repellent when it was described to me. It sounded, I say in the book, that it's like Valentine's Day with a gun to your head. I really didn't like that at all because I am not a very sentimental guy. I find it pretty off-putting. But again, there's a bunch of science that suggests that these practices really can have health benefits and that in some cases can perhaps even change behavior. And that, as always, kind of put me over the edge. And I started doing it and I found them to be really useful practices.
That's great. So what do you say to people who are nervous or anxious or afraid to feel vulnerable when they go into this kind of stillness that might be for their very first time? You know, as you're going around the country in this bus for 11 or 12 days and you're talking to people who are, not only do they not have time, which many people use that as a reason, but they're also, they're just afraid to sit still. They've never done it.
Well, this is one of the fears that we tackle in the book.
Yeah.
We call it Pandora's Box. A lot of people are worried that if you sit and meditate, they're going to face a lot of difficult stuff. And the truth is, you might. So there are two things to say about this. One is, if you have what you believe is trauma, I would advise that you meditate under the guidance of a trained mental health professional. For the rest of us, though, who just have what the amazing author Mark Epstein describes as the trauma of everyday life, for the rest of us who have this worry that we're going to be facing our demons, again, the truth is, you may. Almost certainly you will. But it's better to see them than to not see them and be driven blindly by them, because they are there. And just because you don't see them doesn't mean they're not there. It means actually that they have their talons in you and they're controlling you in ways that you can't see because you've chosen not to see them. So my argument is, it's better to go in there and do that work than it is to just be subconsciously, unconsciously yanked around.
Yeah, that's so well put. I interviewed you about 2 years ago, maybe after it came out.
Yeah, the book came out 4 years ago, but I think I interviewed with you several years after it had come out.
Yeah, I think it was like the paperback version.
Yes.
Right after the paperback version came out. And you told me you were meditating for 2 hours every morning. Are you still doing that?
So 2 hours every day, but not every morning.
Okay.
So my rule is, actually Sharon Salzberg, who you talked about before, told me about a friend of hers. I had always had it in my mind that serious meditators did 2 hours a day. I don't know where I got that from, but it was in my head. And I want to write more books about meditation, particularly what I call the deep end of the pool, as we head toward this idea of enlightenment, whatever that is. So I really wanted to up my game. So again, I had in my mind that 2 hours was the magic number. But I couldn't imagine doing 2 hours, especially in one go. My schedule is all over the map. On the weekends, I do Good Morning America. During the week, I do a late night show, Nightline. I travel all the time. I just couldn't imagine getting that done. Sharon told me about somebody who she knew who wanted to do 2 hours. And he set a rule of, like, I'll do whenever I want, wherever I want, and in whatever increments I want. But by the end of the day, I'll get to 2 hours.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that unlocked it for me. And that allowed me to do it. So basically, I just fit it in when I can. Today, I've done, right now, we're doing this interview at 5:30. I'm way behind. So today, I've done 30 minutes. I did like 8 minutes in an Uber, another 6 minutes on another Uber ride. And then I came back. I did like 16 minutes right before I talked to you. And then sometime during the rest of today, I will get the other 90 minutes in. And if I don't, I'll make it up tomorrow because I have a bunch of plane flights. And that's a great time to meditate.
Well, that's a great commitment to have, especially for a fidgety guy. I mean, it's great that you can do it in different intervals and that you feel good at the end of the day that you've done it or you can make it up.
Yeah, another thing for fidgeters is that if I'm overwhelmed by restless energy, well, first I try to sit with it for a little while, but sometimes it's just so much that you just can't, I can't sit with it any longer. Walking meditation is a great practice. You just literally walk back and forth very slowly and feel the sensations of walking. And when you get distracted, start again. So I do a lot of that. I think last night before I went to bed, I did a ton. That's a great alternative. And I can do that in my office.
Can you do that when you're walking from your apartment to your office? Because I know you live, what, like 3 or 5 blocks from your office.
So that
probably get crushed in New York City if you do that.
Yeah, I would call that more of an informal walking meditation.
Yeah.
So mindfulness meditation basically just means paying attention to whatever is happening right now. So you can pay attention to the sensations of walking, the noises in the street, the sights you're seeing, and when you get distracted, start again. It absolutely is meditation. I wouldn't count that as part of my what I call formal 2 hours, but it is a good thing to do nonetheless.
I love that. I think I'm going to start with an hour and try it at different times during the day. That's
great.
Really great advice. I like that. I love interviewing you because you make me laugh and you give us really great advice that's practical, and you're so good with language. I love how you articulate these teachings. It's awesome.
Really, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Is there anything else from the book or from the road trip or anything else you want to share with us?
No, I think you did a great job covering it.
Okay, well, good. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm so grateful for your time.
My pleasure. I'm grateful to you. Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks to Dan for his great and funny insights. You can find both of his books at all major booksellers. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store. We'll see you next time.